Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews on books, movies, music, and collectibles in the national pastimes. These podcasts feature interviews with authors, artists, musicians, and filmmakers. You know the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. The high holy days are upon us, and each year brings the inevitable question, will the handful of Jewish major leaguers play on Yom Kippur, the holiest day in the Jewish calendar, or will they sit? The most prominent stars to refrain from taking the field during this time were Hank Greenberg and Sandy Koufax, although guys like Sean Green, Al Rosen, and Art Chansky did so with less fanfare. Koufax's stand came on the national stage when he declined to take the mound for the first game of the 1965 World Series. But Greenberg played at a time when anti-Semitism was much more prevalent in America. Ray Robinson, a veteran baseball author whose works include Iron Horse, Lou Gehrig and His Time, Pennants and Pinstripes, The New York Yankees, 1903 to 2002, and Maddie, an American Hero, Christy Mathewson of the New York Giants, among others, recently released a new ebook, High and Tight, Hank Greenberg Confronts Anti-Semitism in Baseball, published by Now and Then. Robinson, 92 years old, had a chance to watch Greenberg play and got to know him. He wanted to express his appreciation for the Jewish superstar who came along at a time when Jews were stereotyped as bookish and unathletic. That Greenberg's star rose during a dark period in world history was even more important. He often said that every home run he hit was a knock against Hitler. I had the chance to talk with Robinson about Greenberg's ordeal, and also about the ways in which Robinson's profession has changed over the course of the last half century. Ray Robinson, thank you for talking with us today.
It's nice to be with you.
So what prompted you to write about Hank Greenberg at this time and in this format?
For two reasons. One, I had a fairly good relationship with Hank while he was alive and always had great respect for him. And I appreciated that during his major league career, he had been subjected to a lot of anti-Semitic abuse, and I thought I would try to clarify the whole matter in an article, and I hope I've succeeded.
Now, you've written biographies about such heroes as Christy Mathewson and Lou Gehrig and others of that generation.
Yes, I've written a whole series of biographies which seemingly concern people from the 1920s and 1930s, including Gehrig, Greenberg, Will Rogers, Christy Mathewson a little earlier than that, and I also did a book on Bobby Thompson's famous home run. So essentially I've been kind of enmeshed in the roaring 20s and the immediate aftermath.
But this one seems a little more personal than the others.
Well, it was just personal because I knew Hank pretty well, and one of my own personal moments with Hank was playing against him in a celebrity press tournament many years ago, a tennis tournament, when he met me in the final and sort of beat the devil out of me. But I always remember that match, and always remembered, as I mentioned in the article I wrote, that here this great slugger of home runs was essentially a lobber in tennis, but a very skillful one. So I pitted my lob against his, and naturally Hank won out.
In going back to the anti-Semitism of the day, now Greenberg wasn't the only Jewish player at the time. Why is it that we never hear about the other Jewish players and their experiences in fighting against anti-Semitism?
Well, I think there were, yes, of course, there were some other Jewish players, several very, very good ones, including Charles Buddy Meyer, who played second base for Washington for many years, and I believe also led the American League in hitting one year. It was Marjanovic of the Philadelphia Phillies, also a very able outfielder. Phil Weintraub of the New York Giants. There were a number of other Jewish players, not as many as there are today, by the way, but The reason you didn't hear too much about them, I think, was that the press very carefully sort of exorcised comments that had to do with anti-Semitism. I don't think you had the kind of openness that you have today.
Let's talk about bench jockeying for a minute. Can you describe, because I don't think they have the players fraternize today. They're friends. They run from team to team, so there's much more camaraderie. But back in those days, what was bench jockeying like?
Well, bench jockeying was seizing upon the physical, mental, and biographical failings, perhaps, of opposition ball players. In other words, the Jewish player like Hank came up, he immediately was subjected to various types of anti-Semitic abuse, name-calling, diminishing him for being Jewish, etc. And the bench-shocking varied from one team to another. Probably was worse with some teams, probably with other teams it was better. That's not to say that anti-Semitism was rampant with everybody or every team. That's not true, but it was there, and very much so, and it wasn't written about much in that period. I don't think the reporters of that time spent an awful lot of time discussing anti-Semitic diatribes.
And this was, it's a little jarring today to think that no one, the umpires, the managers, wouldn't try to put a stop to this.
Well, I think you had some very well-meaning umpires who, listening in on the abuse, which they couldn't miss, did try. In the World Series of 1932, umpire George Moriarty got sick and tired of hearing the abuse in the Chicago Cubs bench. Oh, no, I'm getting a little mixed up here. I'm sorry. That's another matter. Cancel that out. The abuse I'm talking about was when Greenberg played in the World Series of 1934 against the St. Louis Cardinals. And there was a good deal of anti-Semitic abuse. And Moriarty, I think at that time, if I'm not mistaken, several times warned the Cardinal bench. And I believe I got ahead of myself here. I think later, you'll pardon me for my slight vagueness because I'm 92 years old.
Ken Orr.
I believe Moriarty, in the World Series of 32, when the Yankees were in it against the Chicago Cubs, tried to put an end to the abuse. But in that series, it wasn't anti-Semitic abuse. The anti-Semitic abuse was in the World Series of 1934, led by the Cardinals, and including people like Dizzy Dean, who, in his own way, by calling Hank Greenberg a Mo and other substitute names, was clearly making comments that one would consider anti-Semitic.
Now, Greenberg played in Detroit, which was famous for such anti-Semites as Henry Ford and Father Coughlin.
Yes, sir.
Would you consider Detroit at that time the most anti-Semitic team in the majors?
I don't think it necessarily reflected on the team.
I'm sorry, I don't mean the team, I mean the city.
Yeah, as much as on the city. Henry Ford was a virulent anti-Semite. That's in the historical record, who published a vicious newspaper that was practically a reprint of Die Stürmer, Hitler's newspaper in Germany. And Father Coughlin, of course, for many years in the 30s, fulminated constantly about Jews, Jewish influence, Jewish bankers, Jewish greed, etc., etc. So Detroit, unfortunately, became the cockpit of anti-Semitism of all the Major League Baseball cities.
Did Greenberg ever indicate in any form that he didn't want to play in Detroit? I mean, in those days, there was no free agency, so basically a player is stuck with his employer until they decide they want to get rid of him.
You're quite right, Ron, but I think Greenberg chose to play in Detroit despite the fact he probably had some awareness of the anti-Semitism of that area, because the other team that might have wanted Hank was the New York Yankees, and they had a fellow named Lou Gehrig playing first base, which meant that if Hank hung around long enough, maybe a decade, he might have succeeded Gehrig at first base. So therefore, Hank, although he probably was aware of some of the anti-Semitism in Detroit, chose to play with the Tigers rather than spend his time sitting on the bench watching Lou Gehrig.
I might be misremembering, but did he have a tryout with the Giants and they decided they didn't want him?
I believe that John McGraw may have looked Hank over. At least he was aware of his presence. McGraw had looked over Lou Gehrig, as you know, previously, and had turned him down. He made very sense. Hank was a New York high school player and also had played a year of college ball in New York. And McGraw, who was a very, very shrewd guy, probably was aware of Hank's abilities. I'm not so sure the historical record would say that Hank was actually given a tryout by McGraw.
Switching gears a little bit, as you and others have written, Greenberg wasn't really much of a synagogue goer. Why do you think it was so important to him to sit out for those high holidays in 1934?
Well, Hank was what one would call a secular Jew. I believe his background, his parents had been Orthodox Romanian Jews, but Hank didn't follow those particular traits of his parents. But later on in his baseball career, when he became almost a symbol for American Jewish athletes, I think he felt it was almost his responsibility and certainly to his parents to sit it out on one Yom Kippur day that happened to fall, during the baseball season.
And he did play, he consulted with the Rabbi Franklin, was it, Detroit, and the rabbi gave him his...
The rabbi more or less gave him...
play on Rosh Hashanah.
Right, gave him his rationale for playing on Rosh Hashanah, which is a day of enjoyment, as opposed to Yom Kippur, which, of course, is a day of atonement.
Have you speculated, as others might, as others have, on what Greenberg's records might have been like had he not missed all those years for World War II?
Well, I'm not the only one who's probably speculated about it. He certainly missed about four seasons, and there's no doubt that he would have added at least another 30 home runs a season during those 4 years that he missed. So you could add 120 or so home runs to his record, not to mention runs batted in, which he was very prolific at producing.
And if I remember correctly, the game he missed for Yom Kippur, he broke a streak that the entire infield had played every single game up to that point?
Yes, I believe that's true. And there's some very fine co-infielders with Hank. Billy Rogel at shortstop and Charlie Gehringer at second. Marv Owen at third. Of course, Hank played first base in that infield. It probably was one of the best infields in the major leagues.
And what about the story that anti-Semitism played into it when he was going for trying to break Babe Ruth's home run record?
Well, there were widespread theories, and there was some of the wisdom out there was that many of the pitchers, most of whom were not of the Jewish faith, didn't want to be part of the pitchers who threw the home runs who would give Hank sufficient home runs to beat Babe Ruth's record of 60, which Ruth created in 1927. There were many people thought that, and Hank himself constantly, vehemently denied that. His son Steve Greenberg has been quoted as saying there's no truth to it. And I think you have to accept what they say as against the statements made by other people who took the contrary point of view.
Now, obviously, Greenberg was a symbol to Jews and non-Jews in his time. Is there any way to compare the generational meaning of Greenberg with Sandy Koufax when he set out the World Series in 65?
Well, I think, yes, it's interesting. Hank and Sandy, of course, are probably the most prominent Jewish ballplayers of all time, perhaps the most prominent Jewish athletes of all time. But Sandy came along at a slightly different period. Following World War II, he came along in the 50s and 60s. And I think the period in which Hank played was quite different. I don't forget that you had the oncoming of Hitler and his anti-Semitic regime. And by the time that Sandy came along, Mr. Hitler was gone and buried, and so was Nazism. And not to suggest that Sandy himself wasn't at times, I'm sure, the target of some anti-Semitism, but I think it was totally dissimilar from Hank's time.
Do you still follow the game today?
I do. Don't spend much time at ballparks anymore because I am getting along in years and schlepping out to Yankee Stadium and or City feels a little difficult to me these days. But yes, I still follow the game. I still see an occasional game and I still write about it. And in late in my life, it's one of the joys of my life. I still love the game. My good friend, who's now dead, Larry Ritter, once said about baseball, the best part about it is its past. I don't agree with him on that, but there's a lot to be said for that, that baseball still relies heavily on nostalgia. Mm-hmm. And nostalgia, as you know, is a very tricky emotion.
Well, why did you choose this format? This format is exclusively an e-book, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I was approached by the editor-in-chief, Ivan D., who I had a previous relationship with. I had often done blurbs for some of his books. He was a very fine publisher in the Midwest. And when he started Now and Then, which I believe is still functioning, he asked me if I had any ideas. And I always wanted to write about Hank. And since I didn't write Hank's autobiography, which is written by Ira Burkow, I took advantage of writing about my own experiences with Hank and all I knew about Hank.
Well, when you were a kid, actually watching players like Ruth and Gehrig and Greenberg, did you ever think that one day you'd be writing about them?
No, I never thought that at that time that I was going to be a journalist. But I think as years went by, I did want to be a journalist. And although I went to Columbia Law School briefly before World War II, and a little bit after World War II, I decided I didn't want to be a lawyer. And so I got involved little bit by little bit into writing nonfiction. And then I got involved with writing for a while, mainly about baseball. But I've written nonfiction generally for newspapers like the New York Times and Washington Post and the Toronto Star-Ledger and for many, many magazines. And most of the stuff I've written over the last 50, 60 years or so has been baseball-oriented.
What about how the job has changed since you started writing? The process, the tools of writing, how has that affected you?
Well, it has affected me because I don't work full-time for anybody. I'm not about to be hired as a columnist at my age. But I have to give you reveal a little bit of a secret. I've always operated a typewriter. Still do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm married to an Olivetti Studio 45. And I assume I still will, if I'm lucky enough to be around in the next 4 or 5 years, I'll still operate my Olivetti.
Yeah. Well, let's hope so. Let's hope you have many more years of excellent writing ahead of you. Thank you very much for talking with us today. I appreciate it. I enjoyed your book. I enjoyed
Ron, thank very you very much. And I forgot to put a little plug in for my favorite book. The one that I've done is a biography of Lou Gehrig, which came out some 22 years ago and is considered to be, I think, and I say this with a certain amount of appreciation, sort of the definitive book written about Lou.
Now, the title of that is Iron Horse, Lou Gehrig in His Time. And let
Correct.
Me just ask you about that before we go.
Yes.
Yeah, you wrote a book in the early 60s, Speed Kings of the Base Paths, baseball.
Yes, that was many, many years ago.
Now, how has that changed over the years? I mean, your bio on Lou Gehrig, and more recently, Jonathan Haig wrote a biography about Lou
Gehrig.
Right,
he did.
What about some of the is it a question of the research that's available later on changes, or is just a journalistic decision about what to include and what to leave out?
I think basically my own judgment about the sentence. Ike's book was a good book. I think what he did primarily that I didn't do, and I congratulate him for that, he did come across some research on things that Lou had written, which I didn't have in my book. On the other hand, there was a lot of the interviews I had at that time when I did my book with people who, of course, had been dead when Jonathan wrote his book. Therefore, they were not accessible to him. So my assumption is that in reading my book, he picked up some of my own research, but that's par for the course. Mm-hmm. You know, Babe Ruth has probably had at least 25 biographies written about him.
Easily.
And one wonders, you know, how much of it is transported from one book to another. A good deal, probably. That's the name of the game for biographers. If you can acquire new research, fine, you know. And if you can't, why, you can still do a book with another point of view.
But is some of the stuff that would appear in more contemporary biographies considered, like, I don't know how to phrase this, a generation ago, we might not have written about some of the more personal things that have occurred.
Ron, I think you're quite right. I think the biographies today of ball players and other athletes are much more, I was going to say brazen, that's not a good phrase, much more open about some very secret and private subjects. And I don't know whether that's good or bad, but that's the way the world is today. And I do think people do like to know a good deal more about the personality and personal lives of some of these people without getting too intrusive. I mean, a very fine biography of Sandy Koufax by Jane Levy came out a few years ago. And there's a lot in there about, you know, some of the anti-Semitism that Sandy was subjected to. And so, you know, the world hasn't changed that much. I'd like to report that it has, but it hasn't. But it's not the same world that Hank functioned in.
I just finished reading a biography about Koufax by Arnold Hanno that was written back in the...
Yes, well, Arnold is a wonderful writer and a good, very dear friend of mine.
And this was published in 1964, so it was obviously before... Koufax retired, but it was also before that 1965 World Series game that he sat out. So it was interesting to see, without writing about that experience, which was such a part of Koufax's legacy, what they write about. Now, your Speed Kings book, would you say, who was that written for? Because I get the feeling that some of these earlier biographies were
those
for
early
younger readership.
They were. They were called for non-adults. They were basically not little boys, but boys' books.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say for kids up to 14, 15, mm-hmm. maybe a little older. But essentially, that didn't mean that it cramped my style. It meant that some of the material in the books was cramped. In other words, I didn't use certain material about cursing or bench jockeying that I did, of course, in other material I've written. But if you read some of those books, I did biographies of Stan Musial and Ted Williams also for those early Random House books. I'm not so sure how different you'd find them from books that would be done today.
Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly there are plenty of books written for younger readers today, but what would you say was the watershed? A lot of people point at Jim Boughton's Ball 4 as a turning point.
Well, Jim Boughton's book, which is written with the help of Leonard Schechter, of course, a very fine sports writer for the New York Post. By the way, a fellow died very young. I would say that was a watershed for many of us journalists, giving us a go-ahead on being intrusive. That's one way I'd put it. You know, and Jim, of course, for many years wasn't very welcome in the Yankee clubhouse because of that book.
So do you think that's a good thing that happened or not, his book?
I think, like, you know, if you read many biographies of famous people, and I'm not talking about athletes now, you read about everything that biographers can come up with. And if they can come up with a life of many marriages, a life of spending much time in brothels. These are in many biographies of very well-known people. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't Jim Bouton that opened up the can, but Jim Bouton opened it up for professional sports people, I think. I mean, biographers have been writing about nasty things for years. I mean, Henry Miller came out how many years ago? God knows how many years ago. And, of course, any number of other authors who specialize in scatological matters, you know. But in athletes hadn't been vulnerable really very much until Jim Bouton took the gloves off.
Are you working on anything now?
I do occasionally write magazine articles. I've written for the Hall of Fame publication. I've written for the Yankees publication. And I still occasionally appear in the New York Times. So I'm not out of it yet.
Good, good. Very good. Well, Mr. Robinson, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate your interview.
And that was the bookshelf interview with Ray Robinson. As you can tell, when you're finished with one train of thought, another door opens and you go off on another entirely different line of conversation. But it was fascinating to talk with this gentleman who has witnessed so much of baseball history. Well, that wraps it up for another podcast edition of the bookshelf. Hope you will come back again next time when we'll have another fascinating guest to talk about their project. As far as my own 501 project goes, I recently received the cover art for the book, and I'm very pleased with it and hope to be sharing it with you. Again, the title of the book is 501 Books Baseball Fans Must Read Before They Die, published by the University of Nebraska Press, coming out in April 2013. Remember, we love your questions, comments, and anything else you care to share. The email address for that is ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com, and don't be shy. All right, thanks, everybody. See you next time.